For the talk, when I think about it, I always try to give you a little bit of Sangha news if I know things that are going on, because we never have enough time to keep in touch. Karen Fitzgerald, who's been sitting with us lately, and she is an important member of the Dharma Hall, Bellingham Dharma Hall, too. She and her husband are awaiting the birth of a baby, but she's not pregnant, actually. So it's an open adoption. It sounds really amazing, actually. It's amazing that this can happen. So this couple sounds like a perfectly healthy couple, but young and not ready to have a baby, got pregnant. And somehow they got, on with some adoption, this adoption agency. And they're able to look through the profiles of all these prospective parents for their unborn child and pick somebody that would really feel right to them, and then call them up, maybe through the agency, and then they made contact, and then they moved, they're from North Carolina or somewhere Po, And anyway, they moved to Bellingham, got to know Karen and her husband, Ted, and as part of the arrangement, which was all arranged, it's totally fine, it's all agreed to in advance, Karen and Ted paid for them to move out here, rented them an apartment, and paid the first couple of months. But then that's it, there's boundaries. And are helping them get all settled in and all this, and any day now the baby will be born, and I don't know if it might even be that they're going to be at the birth, I'm not sure about that. And the baby is born, and then it's Karen and Ted's baby, and this other couple has solved the problem of not being ready for this baby, and has a whole new life. So isn't that amazing? Yeah. So that's what Karen and Ted are doing, and why we haven't seen them. I talked to her a couple of days ago. There was no baby. I figured, they'd had the baby, but now they're just so busy, getting to know this couple and helping them. And it sounded great. And a little bit overdue Sangha report. Some of you might remember Kelly Margulies, now known as Kelly Dennison, but some of you might not know her so much. I saw her a little while ago. I forgot to tell you. She and her husband somehow got the notion to move to Alaska. So it's really hard to understand why, but they seem to have a sort of very, some couples sort of move in their own world, and they seem to have a really big dose of that. Like they're their own kind of unit, and Arcata, California was too busy or something, so they had to be in Alaska. So anyway, we saw them for about 2 hours before they got on the ferry. They seemed perfectly healthy, but there was there's some little sadness there. I think we haven't heard the last of Kelly. Hopefully, she'll be back once whatever it is going on has played out. And there's someone else I was going to tell you about. But I forget who. Anyway, this is a momentous evening for me. A milestone. Because I set out a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, to give talks on 25 koans, which our guiding teacher, Norman Fisher, has selected from out of about 300 more or less in the main koan collections, being Zen stories. And so it's a bit overwhelming. It's a big literature. So he picked 25, so I thought, okay, at least I should study these. And so I set out to give a talk in every one, and this tonight is number 25, so it's the last one, so we can talk about something else. So it's a milestone for me, but it's also, I realize, just another talk, just another evening, just another breath. And I was remembering in about, I think, 1993 or so, my wife and I took a bike tour in England, in Europe and England. And in England, we're riding along on our bikes, and we saw actual milestones. So it's this little stone on the side of the road with a number carved in it, all mossy and old, really beautiful, the way we map beauty onto old things. And I think it was on the road from London to Oxford. And I don't know if there was really one every mile or it was just periodic, I can't remember, but... and of course, when they were created, there were not so many maps or, there wasn't much information, and so milestones must have been really helpful. And you're walking or riding in a cart or something. And we were talking the other day downstairs sometime about colloquialisms and where they come from, and it's sort of interesting to think about, you know, the way our language and our thinking, we have quite a bit of embedded knowledge that we don't really think of and we're hardly even aware of. And so when I saw that milestone, it was this really kind of moment, like, oh, that's what that is, you know, that's what a milestone is, you know. We have so many things like that that are planted deep in our consciousness, waiting to be activated. And I thought to myself, well, religious practice does that too. Like in Zen, the way we chant sutras, like the Heart Sutra, or Zen poems, like the merging of difference and unity. You know, we chant them over and over and over again, and we don't really know, in a way, what we're saying. You know, we just chant them, because it's a practice, and everyone else is doing it, and we try to follow along. You're doing a beautiful job following along, by the way. It must be pretty awkward to be the first time, you know. But, you know, just like when we say, oh, this is a milestone for me, we don't really think about what that word means and where that comes from. You know, we don't really know that we're talking about a mossy stone alongside a road with a number chiseled in it. But something, you know, gets planted, the way we live and the way we practice, things are planted. And one day, conditions will be right, and some knowledge or some wisdom will be activated, and, you know, inevitably, almost. And when that happens, it's a beautiful feeling. You know, we feel our life is a little broader and a little deeper than the way we thought it was. So, milestone, a little digression about milestones. One of the things about giving talks, so I was reflecting, you know, 25 talks, giving talks, you know. One of the things I've really learned from giving talks is something about humility. You know, and just doing one's best, you know, doing my best even when I'm not terribly comfortable, even when I'm not at all convinced of my own brilliance or worthiness, even when I don't have, like, lots of time to prepare, and I don't feel like I'm doing it right. You know, so when I sit down to write, to prepare the talk, I often notice, you know, the many things I hold in my mind about preparing a talk and about study and about, you know, Zen teachers and all this stuff. And I notice often that, you know, I hold in my mind a vision that I always fall short of and will always fall short of. A vision in which I'll have lots of time to study, you know. And, you know, I suppose I do have maybe more time than I really use well, but not this much time. I would never have this much time, the amount of time I think I should have in my mind. You know, that I would be studying and thinking and meditating about koans for weeks and months in a beautiful little hut in the backyard all afternoon with a little cup of tea and no telephones or computers, you know, everything very quiet, birds singing outside, probably the sun just like halfway behind a cloud, you know. You know, that I really, you know, that's, you know, I hold that in my mind as how it's supposed to be. And so every time I sit down to write a talk, I suffer because things are not actually that way. It's not realistic to think that that will be the conditions. And, you know, it's not like completely not right either. The visions we hold in our mind of who we're supposed to be are not completely out to lunch. I mean, I do study mostly before giving a talk, but I do study. I do sit almost every day. I do seem to have kept at it for 20 years or so. But I had to recognize, thinking about, you know, preparing talks and giving talks, that I'm not a scholar in the way that I fantasize a scholar should be. And so whenever I'm caught on that, I suffer and I feel inadequate and unhappy. But then, on a good day, I remember my actual life, which is why I don't have time to be an idealized scholar, as I'm busy having an actual life, which is a wonderful life, with a family that I put a lot of time and energy into and really enjoy, with a 100-year-old house that always needs maintenance and tidying up, with this wonderful sangha and our adventures in this place. In that I have a lot of things that I need to do. Work and coordinating with people. And so anyway, I notice this feeling of inadequacy and this feeling of being unprepared and not being complete. So I notice that, and I do my best to let it go and just prepare the talk. And that's something I really appreciate about Zen training, that we have all these little opportunities to study this, to study the way that we hold in our mind some idealized life that is not our life and that causes us to suffer if we get caught on it. Because in Zen we have these the formality of it and the ritualness of it provides lots of little opportunities in the little jobs that have to get done. You know, like the other day Diane started doing the chant leading in the noon service, you know. And we have these little opportunities to do something where you don't necessarily feel like you really know how to do it right and you're not necessarily that comfortable, but you do it anyway. And you do it in front of people. And I think that's also a great part of the Zen, you know, method, that these things are really activated and really function only in community. These things only function in community. You don't really learn that much about yourself if you showed up here all by yourself to practice chant leading and said, oh yeah, I'm pretty good at it, all right, you know. Or, oh, I'm never going to be good at this. I mean, it doesn't really function. It doesn't help you understand your life and the ways that you are caught and the ways, therefore, you can be freed. So we get a little discouraged and we notice we're caught. But it's a little bit irrational to be discouraged when we notice we're caught, because if we notice we're caught, then what exists in that moment is the possibility of freedom, the possibility of release. If you don't know you're caught, there's no possibility of release and freedom. So we create this together. We create something together that's bigger than me or you, and it's bigger than us. And we have lots of words and markers for what we're trying to create together. We don't really know what it is, but we have some abstract nouns to throw around, like peace or emptiness or awakening, but we really don't know what it is. And it's not exactly a thing, anyway. But somehow, as human beings, we support each other to find a way to remember. To remember the perfectness and completeness of our actual life. So the Buddha, you know, he didn't teach that all life is suffering. It gets misunderstood that way a little bit. He taught that the things that we often try to find satisfaction and lasting happiness in just don't work out. So me clinging to some imaginary other life of the perfect sort of monk scholar and wanting things to be other than the way they actually are right here, right now, it just doesn't work out. We can study that and eventually maybe we'll remember it. You know, not to say that we can't change some things and we can't arrange our life a little bit, but I forget what I was trying to say in this whole part here. So I'm going to let it go. I probably already made that point without reading the paper. Well, anyway, back to the koan project. This was a long digression. So, guess who the subject of our 25th koan is? It's not actually another one of these Tang Dynasty Chinese Zen masters that we've been talking about in these talks. Actually, the central character in the 25th koan of the list is the wonderful and exasperating character that John Bales introduced us to. It was just here. It's about Vimalakirti. It's not actually the 25th one on the list, like number 15, but I skipped it because I couldn't make any sense of it before. But John introduced us to us here, you know, for a couple of months, introduced us to Vimalakirti, and I had no choice but to try to give a talk on it, so it seems like it's going to work out. And many of you attended John's class. I didn't get to go very much. But here's a little bit about Vimalakirti, which probably John explained. He's understood in the tradition to have been an enlightened lay student of the Buddha and contemporary of the Buddha. And that he was a really very wise and accomplished practitioner, and he especially really understood emptiness, a real hand on feeling for emptiness, and understood it so well that he could actually correct and instruct the Buddha's main monks. And so it's important and interesting that he was a lay person, not an ordained person. And he's a central figure in a sutra that John studied with us called the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra. And the sutra was composed, we think, in Sanskrit sometime around 100 years in the common era. And it was translated into Chinese about 100 years later, about 200 AD. But the Sanskrit original was lost, and now it only survives in Chinese and Tibetan translation. And like much wonderful and wise religious literature, its historical accuracy is pretty questionable, actually. Because we don't actually really know if Vimalakirti existed. And if he did exist, probably existed. Whether he was anything like the person portrayed in the sutra is not known. One thing we know is that his name was never mentioned in any of the canonical Buddhist texts that were preserved in a complete collection in Pali. And the first time he gets mentioned is in the works of an Indian mystic sage called Nagarjuna, about 200 before the Common Era, about 300 years after the Buddha. It's the first time that Vimalakirti is ever mentioned. And so I have this famous idea of my own that I think I cooked up, maybe I heard it somewhere, that there's three things we should always consider in approaching religious literature, and that we need a balance in all three of these. And the three things are, first, the historical, the actual historical, you know, scientific truth. You know, so Vimalakirti, maybe not the way it says in the sutra, but definitely very old and important literature composed by, you know, serious meditators, serious scholars of the mind and the heart. So the first is the historical and scientific sort of angle on the thing. And the second, though, is the devotional angle on it, which I think is really important and underutilized in our culture. We're pretty good at scientific skepticism, you know, which can make us a little cold, you know, and a little removed and a little cut off from the beautiful potential of the world. And so the second sort of angle and approach on religious literature like this Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra is the devotional, which is to actually see it as true, you know, which is pretty much the way John Bales was presenting it, I think. You know, John seems to have a good sense of the devotional approach to practice, which is great. You know, we need people like that, you know. You know, to really study this stuff and feel this stuff and visualize, you know, these characters as real beings that definitely said these things and are definitely talking to us and definitely have something important to say that we better listen to, you know. Anything less would be disrespectful, and anything more would be beautiful and wonderful and really help us. So there's a devotional truth. And then the third truth, which Norman emphasizes quite a bit, is the truth of it in our actual life, the practice truth. The practical practice truth of the religious teaching in our life. What does this actually mean to me? You know, how does this really actually play out in my life, and how could this actually help me, like right now, you know? Not like later when I've memorized it and gone to many seminars and all this, but, you know, studying this right now, what is this for me? You know, what is it really to study? What is this? You know, what is it for me? How does this support me? How do I connect to this or not to connect to this? And is there something interesting and important in the ways that I can't connect to it, you know? One time I did go to John's class, I don't know if I was tired or somehow I was just a little out of phase, but I could barely focus on a word he said. It was really interesting, you know? I had a huge resistance, you know? I wasn't mad at him, I wasn't upset, and I didn't particularly have any judgmental thoughts about his presentation or the way he was doing or anything like that. I was like I was in another place or something like that, you know? And so I don't actually know what that meant, but I paid attention to it as much as I could. Anyway, so a little about Vimalakirti and approaching this kind of stuff. So tonight's koan is actually a quotation from that very sutra. It's a quotation from the end of chapter 9. You all memorized chapter 9, right? Remember what happened in chapter 9? It's maybe about the third class, you know. You were there, or you weren't. In which Vimalakirti has a conversation with Manjushri. Well, there's quite a few conversations with Manjushri, but this is an important one. And so the koan, the Chan masters of old chose this as an important thing to study. And I think, you know, the context would have been that their students would actually be familiar with the sutra. You know, so it's lucky that John gave that class. Because, you know, sometimes I think the sort of naive, you know, Western, you know, mystical approach to koan literature, which doesn't seem to get you too far, is you take the koan book, you open it at random or something, and you read three or four lines, and you go, you know. And maybe something will happen, you know. Like, I remember I used to cast the I Ching without any idea what it really meant, and it was kind of like, bang, something's got to come out of this, you know. And maybe something does, you know, maybe something does, but I think that's not the full sort of breadth of tradition. Actually, you would have some context. So here's the case. And it's presented in two of the main collections, the Book of Serenity, in which it is case 48, and the Blue Cliff Record, in which is case 84. And actually, I have a little difference. So I'm going to read you the Book of Serenity version first. A little later, I'll mention a little bit about the Blue Cliff Record version. So the collectors of these koans always wrote a little introduction to kind of warm you up, get you ready. And so here's the introduction by a teacher named Wan Song. Even if one's subtle function is universal, there's a place where one can't even begin to act. Even if one's eloquence is unhindered, there is a time when one can't open one's mouth. Lang Ya was a handless man boxing. Jian Xiong made a tongueless man speak. Who is it who can extricate oneself midway? Hear that again? Even if one's subtle function is universal, you know, like you know exactly what to do, there's a place when one can't even begin to act. Even if one's eloquence is unhindered, there's a time when one can't open one's mouth. Lang Jia was a handless man boxing. Jian Shan was a tongueless man able to speak. Who is it who is able to extricate oneself midway? If I was a good scholar monk, I would have figured out who Lang Ya and Jian Shan are, but I didn't. So anyway, that's the introduction. The case is, Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a bodhisattva's method of entering non-duality? Manjushri said, according to my mind, in all things, no speech, no explanation, no direction, and no representation, leaving behind all questions and answers. This is the method of entering non-duality. Then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, we have each spoken, and Vimalakirti has spoken a lot this time, you know, this is like a couple hundred pages in. We have each spoken, and now you should say, good man, what is the bodhisattva's method of entering into non-duality? Vimalakirti was silent. Is that familiar? Yeah, a little bit. I don't know if John remembered that was a koan when he got to that in the book, but here it is again. Vimalakirti, so a pseudo-historical lay adept and a, you know, supernatural bodhisattva were having a conversation one day, you know, to bring up the topic of non-duality, the topic of the artificialness of all the distinctions we make in things and how that causes us, you know, to create these funny distinctions and different ideas like I was talking about earlier. So we're talking about non-duality and asking each other how to approach it, you know, how to practice that, how to actually do that instead of just, you know, jaw about it. And Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is a bodhisattva's method for entering non-duality? And Manjushri said, according to my mind, you know, according to me, in all things, always, no speech, no explanation, no direction, and no representation. Leave behind all questions and answers. This is the method of entering non-duality. That sounds good, you know. Makes sense. And then he asks Vimalakirti in return, we have each spoken. Now you should say, good man, what is a bodhisattva's method of entry into non-duality? Vimalakirti was silent. So apparently this was a really important story for Zuedo, who's the teacher who compiled the Blue Cliff record, because he's mentioned in the commentary in the Book of Serenity, and he actually inserts himself into the Blue Cliff record version, which is interesting. He inserts a comment on what the silence really says. So he must really have studied this silence of Vimalakirti. You know, what is that silence? You know, what kind of silence is that? You know, there's lots of different kinds of silence, right? There's the silence of just like, you know, being stuck, you know, not, there's a silence of fear, you know, there's this, you know, it's not just one kind of silence. We think in Western thinking, well, either you're talking or you're not, and not talking is silence, so that's silence, that's the end of the story. But there's many kinds of silence. So what is Vimalakirti's silence? You know, what is that? And so Zuedo says that what that silence is completely exposed, is one translation. That silence is completely exposed. Another translation is seen through. That silence is the silence of seeing through. So two different translations of the same Chinese phrase. Maybe later we'll get Bob to figure out what the Chinese is. And this exposed and thorough silence also makes me think of giving these talks. Because it sounds so zen, you know, so cool to be silent. You know, be better, you know, not to say anything. But it's not actually that easy to do. Because we have such a deep, you know, desire to dance around and reassure ourselves and others instead of really saying what's in our heart. So here's a little more context on this story. So chapter 9, the entire chapter is pretty simple structure. It's a whole bunch of different bodhisattvas chiming in on this question, one after another, you know, one paragraph each, the way it's written in English. And we don't have time to read the whole chapter, and you'd all fall asleep anyway, but I picked out three or four to give you a flavor. And then at the end of that, you know, after, I forget, about 20 or 30 bodhisattvas, I'll give their take on how to practice non-duality. You know, what is this life beyond being stuck on distinctions? After they all chime in, then Manjushri has the last word, and Vimalakirti has the last non-word, I guess. So, Vimalakirti opens it, and he asks all the assembled bodhisattvas, "Good sirs," you know, he announces to the room, "Good sirs, please explain how bodhisattvas enter the Dharma door of non-duality." And they each responded with a short saying. For instance, the Bodhisattva Shrikuta declared, "Defilement and purification are two. When there is thorough knowledge of defilement, there will be no conceit about purification. The path leading to the complete conquest of all conceit is the entrance into non-duality. Defilement and purification are two, or you think they're two. When there's thorough knowledge of defilement, there will be no conceit about purification. The path leading to the complete conquest of all conceit is the entrance into non-duality." Then the Bodhisattva Tishya declared, "Good and evil are two. Seeing neither good nor evil, the understanding of the non-duality of the significant and the meaningless is the entrance into the non-duality." I like that part. The understanding of the non-duality of the significant and the meaningless is the entrance. So we think, you know, that's meaningless, that's important, you know. He's saying understanding the non-difference of those two is the entrance. Then the Bodhisattva Simhamati declared, "To say this is impure and this is immaculate makes for duality." What kind of accent do you suppose Bodhisattvas had, you know? This is kind of a Texan, you know. "One who obtained an equanimity." Anyway, sorry. I mean, they come off as so lofty and pure, you know, but how are they supposed to have talked? Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Simhamati. "To say this is impure and this is immaculate makes for duality. One who, attaining equanimity, forms no conception of impurity or immaculateness, doesn't even occur to them, yet is not utterly without conception," it's not a vegetable, has equanimity without attainment of equanimity. He enters the absence of conceptual knots. Enters the absence of conceptual knots. So don't enter those conceptual knots. Enter their absence. Knots like a... Sorry, yeah, K-N-O-T, yeah. Knots like tying a knot. Like the knot in your back. Then the Bodhisattva Suddhadimkuti declared, to say this is happiness, that is misery, is dualism. One who is free of all such calculations through the extreme purity of gnosis, of knowledge, his mind is aloof, like empty space, and thus he enters into non-duality. To say this is happiness, this is misery, is dualism. When he was free of these calculations, through the extreme purity of wisdom, her mind is aloof, like an empty space, and she enters into non-duality. Then the Bodhisattva Pramati declared, I and form are dualistic. To understand the I correctly, and not to have attachment, aversion, or confusion with regard to form, this is called peace. Similarly, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, body and touch, and mind and phenomena, all of these are dualistic. But to know the mind, and to be neither attached, averse, nor confused with regard to phenomena, this is called peace. To live in such peace is to enter into non-duality. So, the ways that we get caught on sensory inputs. To not be attached, nor averse, nor confused, you know. Not to just, you know. It's good that they mention confused, you know. Don't be confused either, be clear. And one more. Then the Bodhisattva Akshayamiti, declared, the dedication of generosity for the sake of attaining omniscience is dualistic. The nature of generosity itself is omniscience, and the nature of omniscience itself is total dedication. Likewise, it is dualistic to dedicate morality, tolerance, effort, meditation, and wisdom. We're referencing some Buddhist lists here. It is dualistic to dedicate these for the sake of omniscience. Omniscience is the nature of wisdom. Total dedication is the nature of omniscience. Thus, the entrance into this principle of uniqueness is the entrance into non-duality, which is a real mouthful. Basically, just practice. Basically what he's saying, just practice. The dedication of generosity for the sake of getting something is dualistic. You know, generous to get a result is dualistic. To just be generous is omniscience, is non-duality. And the nature of non-duality itself is that total dedication. So just dedicating yourself to practice, to generosity, is the gate. And it's therefore dualistic and useless to dedicate things like morality and tolerance and effort and meditation and wisdom for a result, you know, for the sake of non-duality. You know, so we say, I'm sitting to get peaceful. And this Bodhisattva is saying that doesn't work. Just sit, you know. Dedicate yourself to sitting. That in itself is already peace. And on it goes, and then the chapter concludes with the bit that's the koan is excerpting. Here's the end of the chapter. This is Bob Thurman's translation from the Tibetan, which I have to disagree with, John. I think that Charles Luck translation is so good. Get the Bob Thurman one. You're already in the book now. Get another book. Anyway, that's just my opinion, which is dualistic. Here's the end of the chapter. When the Bodhisattvas had given their explanations, you know, we're done. They all addressed the Crown Prince Manjushri. He's like, you know, a higher level Bodhisattva. He's a great Bodhisattva. When we say Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, he's in that gang. And they said, you know, like with one voice, Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's entrance into non-duality? The thing I appreciate about these sutras is that, which we could learn from, is this emphasis on there's not one answer, you know what I mean? And I don't think it was like, you know, they went around, each one stated their understanding as best they could. I don't think, the way it's written, it's not like we would have been. It's not like Bodhisattva number three is like, oh, number two already said the good stuff. I got to think of something else, you know. You know, they didn't worry about that. You know, they appreciated each other's answers, and they gave their answer, and it didn't, you know, freak them out too much that their answers were not exactly the same, a little different. But they also, you know, have some humility and want to ask, you know, a higher authority too, you know. So we can learn from that, you know what I mean? And we want there to be like, oh, what's the answer? Okay, it's three, all right. Well, can we, next agenda item, please, you know. They're willing to spend a few hours, you know, discussing item one. Anyway, so they asked Manjushri, and he said, good sirs, you have all spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know no one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing. That is the entrance into non-duality. You know, so as soon as you say something, you're not talking about non-duality, which is the problem, you know. That's why this literature is so long. It's like you can't say it, so they keep trying different ways, you know. So you've all spoken well, but your explanations aren't dualistic. And then the Crown Prince Manjushri said to Vimalakirti, well, we have all given our own teachings, noble sir. Now, may you elucidate the teachings of the entrance into the principle of non-duality. Thereupon, Vimalakirti kept his silence, saying nothing at all. The Crown Prince Manjushri applauded Vimalakirti. Excellent! Excellent, noble sir! That is indeed the entrance into non-duality into the non-duality of the Bodhisattvas. Here there is no use for syllables, sounds, and ideas. When these teachings have been declared, well, that's the end of the quote, and when these teachings have been declared, 5,000 bodhisattvas entered the door of the Dharma of non-duality and attained tolerance of the birthlessness of things. And that's the end of the chapter. And I really appreciate that Bob Thurman's translation about tolerance. I forget how Charles Look said it. Part of what we're doing is developing tolerance for the actual nature of things, you know. It turns out it's not the way we thought, and it freaks us out a little bit, but actually it's okay. You know, we can develop the ability for it to be okay, and to be better, actually. So, but what to make of all this, you know, on a practical level, you know, with my third angle. So I wasn't coming up with much, so I thought we might appreciate a little bit of a talk by a great American Zen teacher, Daido John Lurie. Daido founded a Zen monastic order. Actually, he's an ambitious Zen guy. He founded an entire order in a major monastery in upstate New York, which would be great to all visit someday. And he gives kind of classic Zen-style talks, which I either don't know how to do or don't want to do. I'm not sure which. But it's good to, it's great practice. And so I want to read you a little bit of Daido Roshi's talk on this case. He reads the case and the verse and all this, and then he says, dualities such as life and death, love and hate, good and bad, sacred and secular, are the cause of much of our anguish and anxiety. If you're still struggling with them, it'll be hard for you to see what the koan mu is all about, you know, what our practice is all about. Even a very beginning koan becomes difficult because we get caught up in these dualities. And when we separate ourselves, we recreate the separate self. It is this separation which is the cause of our suffering. To be with mu, so they're referring to the sort of first koan that you do in formal koan practice, but you can just replace mu with practice. To be with mu, to be with the practice, means to forget the self. And you can't forget the self if you're constantly recreating it. The question is, how do you put to rest the myriad streams of thought that course continuously through your head? That's the fundamental matter in working with the breath. To be with the breath, with the whole body and mind, is no different than being with mu, with the whole body and mind. But the problem is that as soon as you move on to mu, the question, what is it, comes up. And the whole intellectual process starts up, and you're back again in this and that, love and hate, good and bad. Dealing with the dualities is a great part of the struggle of practice. But what are those dualities about? Where do they come from? What makes us act like a moth flying into the flame, constantly recreating ourselves, even though we know that that's the source of pain and suffering? And then he talks about Vimalakirti and the case, the setup of the case, and the sutra. And he says, I watch people who are into the health food craze. Which we don't really say anymore. I must have said this a little while ago, the health food craze. I watch them run around doing all kinds of exercises, drinking water from Switzerland, eating acorns, worrying about extending their lives, and all the while they're constantly angry at themselves and their jobs and everything around them. They're fearful and anxious, and all that good water and good food, and all the good water and good food in the world isn't going to help them if they turn it into poison by the way they use their minds. So it's really important to set the mind at rest. When you set the mind at rest, you set the body at rest. Mind and body are one. In the sutra, the Buddha finally convinced all the great bodhisattvas to see Vimalakirti and listen to him. None of them really wanted to go. Each time they visited, Vimalakirti gave them a hard time. So Vimalakirti would basically, you know, sort of trounce them, you know, with his understanding of emptiness. He'd say, well, you know, like the thing in the chapter 9 there, you know, they all said their thing and he had a better answer. So the Buddha's, you know, the Buddha's disciples got kind of burned out. They didn't want to go visit him. And do you remember the setup of the story is that Vimalakirti was ill. He had some kind of long illness and he was bedridden. And so the Buddha was sending his students to visit him, and they didn't want to go. But they did anyway, so we got a sutra out of it. And then Dida goes on. Finally, Vimalakirti asked the same question to Manjushri, an extraordinary person of great spiritual stature. And Manjushri said, according to what I think, in all things, no words, no speech, no demonstration, and no recognition. To leave behind all the questions and answers, that is entering the Dharma gate of non-duality. Engo, which is the Japanese name for one of the Blue Cliff Record commentators, said, since the other 32 bodhisattvas used words to dispense with words, Manjushri used no words to dispense with words. At once he swept everything away, not wanting anything, and consider this to be the Dharma gate of non-duality, you know, which is better. And he certainly didn't realize that this was the sacred tortoise dragging its tail, that in wiping away the tracks, it was making traces. Isn't that a great image? Sacred tortoise dragging its tail. So Manjushri is using words, so he's making tracks with his words. But his words were pretty good, so he's dragging his tail behind to rub them out again. But there's still a trace. And then Dido says, sea tortoises come out of the water and onto the beach to hide their eggs. They conceal them in the sand, and then they backtrack back into the water using their tail to wipe away the tracks so that predators won't get to the eggs and eat them. But of course, when they swish their tail to cover the tracks, they leave the tracks with their tail, which are just as visible to predators. And what Engo is saying is that Manjushri's reply still left traces. Then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, we've all spoken, now you tell us, good man. What is the bodhisattva's entry into the Dharma gate of non-duality? And so Vimalakirti was silent. And another comment that Zuido was talking about earlier, made in this koan, is talking about the kind of silence, completely exposed. So Dido says, where was the exposure? You have to understand that none of this has to do with gain or loss, right or wrong, being or non-being. It's like Engo likens it to being up a 1,000-foot cliff. And he says, if you can give up your life and leap off, you will see Vimalakirti in person. If you cannot give it up, you're like a ram caught in a fence, which is classic Zen talk, you know, jump off the cliff. But there's something to that, you know. Can we let go of our comfort zone? And can we just jump into this life? Otherwise, we're caught in a fence. And Dido says, we come to practice with a sickness of anger, of fear, with mistrust, with love and hate, and soon they begin to manifest in the practice itself. We see them functioning in groups, in families, in nations, and in cultures. We see all these dualities driving us, driving everybody. Is it possible to function in this life in a non-dual way? Is it functional not to be caught in these dualities? Vimalakirti said yes. The Buddha said yes. Manjushri said yes. Countless Buddhas and ancestors from time immemorial have said yes. But in the garden, in order to grow a cabbage, we send people out to pull the weeds, give the cabbage room to grow so it can grow and be nourished. But this also causes the weeds to wither and die. Isn't a weed just as much a life as a cabbage? Isn't a cabbage just as much life as we who kill and eat it? Isn't the deer that we keep away from the cabbage by putting an electric fence around it just as much life as we are? Can a cabbage be grown and consumed non-dualistically? Can nations exist in a non-dual way? How? Can relationships exist in a non-dual way? How? Keep in mind that ultimately this Dharma is transmitted non-dualistically. Nothing is received. Nothing is passed on. Does silence, relinquishing all activity, satisfy non-duality? It's just one side. It doesn't do it. Can't do it. But then why did Vimalakirti respond with silence? Somehow, we forget what it means to accomplish the way. Our tendency is to think that accomplishing the way is a goal. Something that at some point in time we will complete, attain, and finish. But that is not what accomplishing the way is. We have a tendency to see all things and evaluate them in terms of a beginning and an end. To accomplish the way is to practice the way. It's the way itself. Practice and realization are not two things. Practice and enlightenment are one. Practice doesn't end with enlightenment. True accomplishment of the way is very difficult to define. Words can't reach it. Even though words can't reach it, intuitively we recognize it when we feel it. It manifests in many ways. Not necessarily in spiritual realms, not necessarily in holiness or perfection, but rather in everyday mundane affairs. It's in washing dishes, changing a diaper, drinking a cup of coffee, and maintaining a relationship or having a conversation. Accomplishing the way always exists in the doing. There's no final resting place. If you stop practicing, it's lost. If you stop using your arm long enough, it atrophies. You need to continually use it for it to be functional. You will never reach a final destination. That's maybe enough from Dido for now. But you can find this talk online, or you can email me, I'll send you the text. That's maybe about a third of his talk. But this thing about the continuousness of practice makes me think of what Norman was talking about. The other morning he was reading from Suzuki Roshi. And do you remember this part? I actually listened on the tape. I wasn't here that morning. But he quotes Suzuki Roshi saying, well, it's kind of like when you eat. You eat a lot, and then you need to go to the bathroom. We have a day. We have a lot of experiences. We fill our mind full of thoughts. And then we sit zazen. So it's just like going to the bathroom. You know. And he said, you know, and you don't go to the bathroom expecting some particular, you know, enlightenment to happen. You just go to the bathroom. You know? You don't have any good or bad expectations, hopefully, you know. You just go to the bathroom. So practice a little bit like that. I remember one of Norman's teachers, Mel Weitzman, used to say, you should treat your daily practice like brushing your teeth. You know, you fully understand that it's a good thing to brush your teeth. But, yeah, your teeth are not going to become different teeth. You know, you're not going to, like, have somebody else's teeth if you just brush them hard enough. They're still your teeth. You just need to brush them. You just need to go to the bathroom. You just need to practice. And then non-duality will, like, creep in. And you never know, like Dido's saying, you never know when you'll have an experience where you really feel this and notice it in a conscious way. It just happens sometimes. Which makes me think, one last story and I'll close, is I ran into a guy at the gym the other day who was wearing this t-shirt. I kind of recognized him and I kind of didn't, but I did a double take at his t-shirt, and he noticed me doing a double take, so we had a conversation. So the t-shirt said on it, on the back it said, Zen Failure. And then, you know, the other t-shirts are like, you know, all the gym type t-shirts, but this t-shirt said, Zen Failure. In the front it said, Thank You and Okay, which is the title of a great book by David Chadwick. Yeah, who we know a little bit. He's been up here. Not for a long time, though. We should invite him back. And so we had a conversation, and he actually didn't know who David Chadwick was, and somebody gave him the shirt. You know, but, you know, I was like, oh, you know. I was all amped to, like, name drop. I was, like, ready to name drop, you know, but he didn't know any of the people I was name dropping. But the reason I mention him is because what he told me was that he doesn't sit so much now, and that his main song is Alcoholics Anonymous, but that in the moment when he finally had kind of started to turn the corner in his battle with alcoholism, you know, and he was starting to be sober again, somebody told him, there's this place, the Bellingham Dharma Hall. You need to go there. You just need to go there. And he didn't, like, sign up for the course or call up or go to any of the organized evening sits. At the time, there was a business in the building, and so it was the old one on Unity Street. So the front door was open, and we kept the door to the Dharma Hall itself open. And he said for about 2 weeks, he went there every day during the day, and he just sat there. He didn't really know how to practice, but he just sat there, and he stared at, there were these beautiful, thick, remember those wood beam floor? Yeah, these, the floor was like a, there was no finished floor. It was just this, these beams on edge that were like, I don't know what, how thick they were, you know, enormous beams, you know, just wood grain, and he would just stare at those beams, and he said, which is why he stopped coming when he moved to the new place, got a really ugly floor. But, you know, anyway, but it was a turning point for him. You know, there was something about being in that place at that time that he could feel the non-dual reality of his life, and he could feel, you know, the breadth of his life, as Norman was saying the other day. So we never know when we'll have that particular experience, but, and we never know the result of what we're doing, how it'll benefit other people. I mean, I didn't know this, you know, this was 10 or 15 years ago, you know. We always wondered if anyone was there during the day, so I guess he was, for a couple of weeks, and it changed his life. So. So what is the method of entering non-duality? In all things, there's no speech, no explanation, no direction, no representation. Leave behind questions and answers. That is the method of entering non-duality. What would you say? What is your method for entering non-duality? Vimalakirti was silent. May our intention equally penetrate